The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
In the aftermath of the tragic violence in Charlottesville, Virginia on August 12th of last year, activists who were there that day have spoken about their experiences on the ground. Katie, who traveled from Syracuse to Charlottesville for the counter-demonstration against the Unite the Right rally, remembers, quote, "Seeing, as soon as we arrived, bands of Nazis roaming around, and thinking that this was going to be dangerous if we couldn't get more numbers out here. Our side was fragmented into lots of different groups, not coordinated together, with no centralized information, and lots of skirmishing. We didn't have overwhelming numbers on our side, and I think that's what made the situation more dangerous," end quote. Bill Burke, a member of the International Socialist Organization who was injured in the horrific car attack, remembers, quote, "Talking to people beside me, when all of a sudden I heard screaming that wasn't part of our chants. I turned and could hear the engine of the car. It sounded like he was on the gas. I turned toward the center of the street where the screams were coming from. I saw people up in the air and people flying toward me. I'm not sure if I was hit by the car or by people in the air who had been themselves hit by the car," end quote. Just 8 days later, and a 10-hour drive north on I-95, a very different scene played out when white supremacists tried to rally on Boston Common. Amy, from Portland, Maine, describes the uncertainty she felt as the march got underway. Quote, "Were we marching into an open confrontation with a hardened, emboldened right and their heavily armed sympathizers in the police force? Would everyone who started the march in Roxbury want to press on if that's what we found? Or would our numbers shrink and leave us vulnerable?" End quote. It soon became evident in Boston that our side, in a truly promising display of solidarity, would outnumber the fascists on a grand scale. Months of organizing a united front across movements and unions and organizations and communities drew estimates of between 25,000 and 40,000 people to the streets of Boston. The fascists mustered maybe 20. Amy writes, quote, "To win a better world, one free of white supremacy, oppression, and exploitation, we will need to go through experiences like yesterday again and again on a larger and larger scale. Boston was a victory that drew us a little bit closer. Today I don't feel fear. I feel the pride and hope that comes from solidarity and mass action," end quote. Now, history is never clean and tidy. Struggle has its ups and downs. And the contest between the forces of white supremacy and the forces for human liberation is, to say the least, messy. To be certain, Charlottesville also featured important victories for the anti-racist counter-demonstrators, who, for example, defended Friendship Court, a low-income housing complex, from right-wing terror. But if there ever was a clear example of the difference an organized mass mobilization of everyone standing against white supremacy makes, this difference could be found in the contrast between the tragedy of Charlottesville and the triumph of Boston. Today, I will address three questions that I believe our present political moment raises. First is, how do Marxists make sense of the far right and fascism? What explains the resurgence of the far right? Second, how should we confront the far right? I'm gonna map out four different answers to this question, The daily threat an emboldened far right presents to immigrants, to black, brown, queer, feminist, Muslim, and Jewish people, and to people with disabilities, coupled with their attacks on our movements and the class struggle, testifies to what's at stake in thinking through this question and to getting it right. And lastly, what alternative must we offer to the far right's politics of hate and fear? There has been no shortage of attempts to catalog the landscape and chart the genealogy of the far right in America today. This is no doubt important, and much credit is due to those on the left doing this dirty fieldwork. A lot of jargon gets thrown around in the effort to rigorously taxonomize the far right. Proto-fascist, far right populist, paleoconservative, white nationalist, white separatist, male tribalist, neo-Nazi, new right, alt-right, you name it. These classifications are incredibly useful in as much as they inform our side's strategic response to the far right, in as much as they could mean life or death for members of oppressed groups. We're bound to get lost in the jungle of these classifications, though, if we don't first have a firm grip on a Marxist theory of fascism. For in one way or another, to classify every horrible layer of the far right is, in essence, to measure every group's distance or proximity to a hardened inner core of fascists. As I'm sure everyone in this room realizes, after 4 days at this conference, there's a Marxist theory for just about everything. Fascism is no exception. Clara Zetkin and Leon Trotsky's writings in the interwar period, during the rise of Mussolini and Hitler, continue to be instructive guides for synthesizing fascism in connection to the global order of racial capitalism. Zetkin, whose writings are compiled right here in this book, which is available like 40 feet from us, she identifies two objective conditions that facilitate the growth of fascism. First, fascism emerges in response to a crisis in capitalism. The petty bourgeoisie, small business owners, bureaucrats, the intelligentsia, who were once promised security and stability, a share of the pie, a seat at the table of the ruling class, find themselves increasingly compressed, squeezed into the ranks of the working class. The, quote, proletarianization of the petty bourgeoisie, in Zetkin's words, compels this class, atomized and isolated between the historical poles of the bourgeoisie and the working class, to put its faith elsewhere. Which leads us to the second objective condition for the breeding of fascism. A crisis of capitalism, Zetkin argues, need not always spell a turn toward fascist ideologues, parties, and mass movements. Only in the absence of, or after the defeat of the left, only after the capitulation, co-optation, placation, or violent crushing of social movements, does a vacuum form in which fascist politics get a hearing. The defeat or betrayal of the left prompts the petty bourgeoisie masses, and even some in the working class, to look elsewhere for the collectivism that the socialists or progressives had promised but failed to deliver. Where is this elsewhere, though? What actually is fascism? The historian Robert Paxton observes, quote, there's no fascist manifesto, no founding fascist thinker. Yet no matter the contradictions and inconsistencies in their doctrines, fascists in practice mythologize the nation above all else, mobilizing extra-parliamentary mass movements in their quest for racial purity and a restoration of the patriarchy through the elimination of internal differences and by way of violent genocidal terror. Fascists tap into xenophobic, chauvinistic, and homophobic sentiments that already circulate under capitalism. And while fascists may cloak their politics in revolutionary rhetoric with appeals to the working class, the class struggle is always violently suppressed in favor of the unity of the nation. Fascist squadrons in Italy during the early 1920s terrorized revolutionary workers' organizations because they had, in Mussolini's words, quote, divided and weakened the nation. Historically, much of the left's confusion, hesitancy, and illusions about the nature of fascism have had to do with its relationship to the capitalist ruling class. In the 1920s and 1930s, Stalinist distortions of this relationship led to the fatal doctrines, the fatal policies of social fascism and popular frontism. According to the ultra-left's theory of social fascism, even social democratic parties are fascist and can therefore not be partners in the struggle against fascism. And according to the opportunist theory of popular frontism, the left must work with and capitulate to the ruling class in order to ward off the menace of fascism, a common enemy. In our contemporary moment, we frequently hear a version of the following two arguments. Maybe some in the crowd have heard these, often paradoxically from the same people. They go something like this. One, the far right in the street is an expression of the ruling class's indomitable power. Confronting the far right is therefore to confront the ruling class head on, and our side just isn't strong enough for that yet. That's one argument you hear. And two, to worry about neo-Nazis is actually a distraction, and completely separate from the systemic violence of racial capitalism. In a world of staggering inequality, climate catastrophe, and endless war, must we really pay attention to these fringe right-wing vigilantes? Neither of these arguments recognizes what both Zetkin and Trotsky understood, the relationship between the far right and the ruling capitalist class. Generally speaking, the ruling class prefers to defend its rule through bourgeois democracy, ideology, and corporate power. However, in a crisis, Trotsky writes, quote, the bourgeoisie is capable of assuring the people neither bread nor peace, This is precisely why it can no longer tolerate the democratic order. It is forced to smash the workers and peasants by the use of physical violence. He continues, while the bourgeoisie makes use of fascism, it nevertheless fears it, end quote, having let loose a mass movement beyond its control. At the same time, even if fascism is born out of the ruling class's failure to assure its people bread and peace, the, quote, nation that fascists mythologize, Zetkin writes, ultimately reveals itself to be the vulgar, unscrupulous bourgeois class state. We can and should have a debate about whether the objective factors that Zetkin points to as preconditions for fascism are to be found in our present moment. But when capital and the state have no answer to economic crisis but a $16.8 trillion bailout, stagnating wages, soaring tuition costs, mass deportations, and a healthcare law that keeps us all in the grips of for-profit insurance companies, well, then the politics of scapegoating get a hearing. These social and economic realities, exacerbated under the stewardship of a Democratic president, left the Democratic Party politically bankrupt and gave Trump an opportunity to run as pro-worker. It is no wonder, then, that the shortcomings of the international ruling class in rebooting the system after 2008 have triggered, in parallel, a political polarization internationally, with the left and the far right gaining traction across the planet, and especially in Europe, where nationalist parties are fueled by virulent Islamophobia. This talk is primarily focused on fighting the far right in the U.S., but we cannot dissociate Trump's victory and the opening it gave to white nationalists in the U.S. from the growth of the Alternative for Germany, Golden Dawn in Greece, the Freedom Party in Austria, the League in Italy, the Party for Freedom in the Netherlands, and the National Rally, formerly the National Front, in France, among others. With all that said, many in this country think it can't happen here. Perhaps Charlottesville and the past 2 years have disabused folks of this belief. From the Minneapolis Silvershirts, the New York Christian Front, and the German-American Bund during the 1930s, to the KKK, the American Nazi Party, White Citizens Councils, Liberty Lobby, and the National Alliance, fascism has a long history in the U.S., shaped in particular by white supremacy. The genocidal terror on which this country was founded, the xenophobic fervor with which the state polices its borders, 2 centuries of racial slavery, and Jim Crow. We might better combat fascists in the streets today by treating them as a constant presence in American history, sometimes in the shadows, sometimes in the streets. The continuity of white supremacy in this nation, of course, runs deeper than any single pointed hat white-robed Klan movement. White supremacy animates the system we live under. White supremacy is not an aberration or a departure from the status quo in a country built on the labor of enslaved black people that starves black communities of resources, incarcerates black people at 5 times the rate of white people, ranks near the bottom globally in the number of refugees accepted per capita, and has a long and racist history of separating families. White supremacists only force institutionalized white supremacy to its logical conclusion in their spectacles of terror. The story of the alt-right's ascendance in America reflects many of the themes common to the far right at large. Drawing on the traditions of the European New Right and paleoconservatism, the alt-right names not a specific organization, but a loose umbrella of ideological currents that first found a foothold online, and in online abuse and harassment, disproportionately targeting women of color. These currents include identitarianists, male tribalists, national anarchists, and neo-reactionaries, and organizations such as the Traditionalist Worker Party, Identity of Europa, the Patriot Front, the Proud Boys, the Fraternal Order of Alt Knights, Identity Dixie, the list goes on. Each with a different emphasis, but all of which ultimately cohere around white nationalism, the building of a white ethnostate. In calibrating our own strategy, it can be helpful to distinguish between, as speakers did at this conference last year, to distinguish between the far-right populists, groups that are fascist in activity without a fascist program, and a hardened inner core of fascists. We can have a debate about where Trump himself belongs. Many have called him a far-right populist, merging promises of jobs with violent and destructive xenophobic policies without, at the moment, enlisting an extra parliamentary mass movement. The fascists in activity but without a program include organizations like the Proud Boys, which might have amorphous politics but nevertheless require members to physically confront anti-fascists at rallies. The Traditionalist Workers' Party and Youth Network, a firmly white nationalist and Nazi sympathizing organization, is fascist without equivocation. Each shell of the far right, in turn, deserves a different kind of response from our side. But however important these distinctions are in shaping anti-fascist tactics and helping us understand the present balance of forces, we mustn't let classifying every loathsome layer of the far right paralyze our resistance. Alexander Reed Ross uses the term fascitization, a dynamic process, to describe how, as objective conditions change, hardened fascists can pull far-right populists and conservatives closer to fascism, and in turn, how far-right populists in power embolden far-right or right-wing vigilantes. We must remember that the classifications of the far right are never static, and that the present we live in is, indeed, in motion. And while the far right may have suffered serious setbacks after Charlottesville last August, thanks to infighting within their ranks, and more importantly, thanks to a renewed resistance, this should not obscure the overall upward trend in their size, their influence, and the threat they pose. The Southern Poverty Law Center recorded an increase in the number of hate groups in the U.S. in 2017, with a horrifying 22% uptick in neo-Nazi organizations. Along with the stabbing of Richard Collins III in Maryland, the killing of two anti-racists in Portland, and the murder of Heather Heyer in Charlottesville, violent hate crimes in the country's six largest cities ballooned by 20% last year. The Council on American Islamic Relations tallied 300 anti-Muslim hate crimes in 2017. It's surely more than that. While deadly violence targeting transgender people and disproportionately trans women of color reached an all-time high last year. As a sequel to last year's Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, a white civil rights rally is scheduled for this August, this time in Washington, D.C., across the street from the far right's friend and ally in the White House. This brings us to the question of the day. How do we confront and defeat the far right? There are essentially four different strategies we could pursue, each wrapped up in its own web of assumptions about our enemy, our movement, and the kind of world we want to build. The first strategy is to ignore the white supremacists when they rally in our streets. Despite how bizarre it might sound, the vast majority of establishment politicians, Republicans and Democrats alike, toe this line. Before white supremacists gathered in Berkeley last August, the Democratic mayor of the city initially implored residents to stay home, since, quote, the best way to silence the white nationalists is by turning your back, apparently. First of all, even if we stay indoors when the white supremacists come to town, it's not as if the media in our hyper-connected world will hold back their television crews. And it never looks like the community cleverly ignored the neo-Nazis. Joke's on you, Richard Spencer, we stayed home. If we don't show up, even if we're not afraid of them, it will always look like the Nazis are unopposed. More importantly, what do the white supremacists learn when they can march down our streets without resistance? Maybe next time around they'll be able to get away with even more. Why not test the limits? Next month or next year, if unopposed, they will take their militias to black churches, as they already have done, and to synagogues and to mosques, to Planned Parenthood clinics and immigrant communities and public gatherings of revolutionary socialists. Conversely, what do we gain by sitting on our asses at home and watching the news coverage of neo-Nazis? We are inevitably left to wonder what most of our neighbors think of these bigots. And that's exactly what the bigots want us to be wondering. If we can't be disturbed enough to take a stand when fascists occupy our parks and brandish their torches, will we have each other's backs when they enter our schools and religious institutions and community spaces? And if our aim is to tear down the whole system of white supremacy, hanging out at home when the white supremacists come to town doesn't exactly look like building momentum to me. But there's also something far more disingenuous about Democratic elected officials pleading for their constituencies to stay home. It's tied up in the liberal enlightenment conviction that in the contest between the racists and the anti-racists, the haves and the have-nots, the oppressor and the oppressed, civil discourse and reason will resolve everything. It might also have something to do with the fact that if we think too long and hard about the Nazis in our streets, some of us might start asking that dreaded question, where'd they come from? And where else would we have to look? Where else would we have to look but 8 years of deepening inequality and a lopsided economic recovery under, hold your breath, a Democratic president? Tactic number two would be to call on the state or the university administration to withhold a permit or in some other way prohibit far-right gatherings from legally taking place. First of all, our side knows very well that you cannot ban or outlaw a grassroots movement. Moreover, this tactic is sort of like a teenager asking his parents to do his dirty laundry for him. Otherwise fiercely protective of his personal space, young Billy now gives his parents permission to enter his room, open his closet door, and take out his hamper of dirty clothes. This sets a dangerous precedent. What else might Billy's parents find? A stash of Halloween candy? A copy of the Communist Manifesto? Whatever else 13-year-olds are hiding in their closets these days. To be clear, the white supremacists here are Billy's dirty socks, and our side is the pile of candy he's been secretly holding onto since last Halloween. Once we've let Mom and Dad cross the threshold into Billy's room to do his laundry, they are also empowered to confiscate his candy. He tried to get out of his doing his chores, but his strategy backfired. Historically, giving the state powers to crack down on groups it deems dangerous, quote, has backfired and will continue to backfire on us, especially as anti-racists are much more threatening to a racist state than a group of racists. That right-wing extremists have historically infiltrated law enforcement agencies also kind of complicates this tactic. From tacit support to joint membership, the cops in the KKK, for instance, have a long, intimate relationship. With common origins in the slave patrols of the South, cops and Klansmen worked in concert to suppress communists in the 1920s, to terrorize black civilians and leaders of the civil rights and black power movements in the 1960s, and to massacre demonstrators at Greenboro's Death to the Klan rally in 1979. The relationship continues today. The cops are remarkably complacent whenever armed fascist squadrons advance in militant formations against anti-fascist protesters. Last year, The Intercept published classified FBI documents, showing, quote, white supremacist extremists often have active links to law enforcement officers. Nevertheless, the FBI has essentially eliminated its unit dedicated to investigating right-wing extremism in the last decade, and there is no universal standard barring white nationalists from joining one of the 18,000 law enforcement agencies in this country. Tactic number three would leave the struggle against fascism to a few hardcore resistors, or in common parlance, Antifa. Before offering some critiques of this tactic, a few remarks. I think we should absolutely applaud Antifa for having stood, with the cops nowhere in sight, between a mob of neo-Nazis and religious leaders last August in Charlottesville. We must defend Antifa against being labeled as a gang. Stand in solidarity with any and all anti-fascist protesters who are criminalized by the state, and oppose the Department of Homeland Security's classification of anti-fascist activities as domestic terrorist violence. The equivocation of fascist violence and anti-fascist violence must be denounced at every turn, especially when it comes from the mouths of elected officials who command the most violent, murderous state in the history of the world.
That's right.
The problem we have here, the critique we have here of anti-fascist tactics isn't even the violence, which is itself often exaggerated. Sure, street scuffling between fascists and anti-fascists may play into the far right's narrative around free speech, and media coverage will inevitably fail to distinguish between the violence on both sides. Whether our tactics can be spun or distorted as provocation, however, is not always the best criterion to use when debating tactics. And we don't renounce violence itself, especially in self-defense, as a tactic. The violence of the oppressor is different than the violence of the oppressed. This is a principle. What's ultimately debilitating about anti-fascist street fighting as the tactic to pursue is its misrecognition of our side's greatest strength in the struggle against fascism. What is our side's greatest strength? Our greatest strength is not our speed, or our muscle, or our martial arts. Even if we were all black belts, our greatest strength wouldn't be in street fighting. Our greatest strength isn't even our wisdom or our humanity. Our greatest strength, by a wide margin, is that most people, our friends, neighbors, coworkers, oppose white supremacists. Our greatest strength is in our numbers. We are many, they are few. Pinning our hopes on street fighting, then, while not off limits, means in effect that we leave our side's greatest weapon at home in a battle we have no choice but to win. When the drama of anti-fascists trading punches with fascists takes center stage, the vast majority of us do become mere spectators. The vast majority of us who are against fascism are told that we can't be anti-fascists because we aren't clad in black and wouldn't stand a chance against a trained fascist militant. We may call this tactic ultra-left, but it can't be terribly radical if the lesson we learn is that ordinary people cannot participate in the struggle for a better world. As long as we continue to substitute the few for the many, and to reinforce the idea that ordinary people cannot be agents of change, our movements and organizations are bound to falter, to crumble, when the time comes to collectively wrest power from the ruling class. Now, Antifa often rebuts these critiques by welcoming a diversity of tactics. You're welcome to have your mass rally in the background while we do our dirty work up front. This isn't even really a response to the critique of spectatorship, but in any case, invoking a diversity of tactics really just means eschewing or delaying entirely a conversation about tactics. Not only does this hamper organizing going forwards, but it's also dangerous. A dozen counter-protests going on at once with different objectives and not much coordination left us vulnerable last August in Charlottesville. Which is all to say that especially when the inner core of neo-Nazis rally in the streets, we must oppose them with the largest multiracial mass mobilization possible, bringing together everyone who stands against white supremacy, liberals and trade unionists and radicals alike. When we think of self-defense, we generally conjure up images of ourselves, alone and in a dark alley, fending off an attack. There's no reason why self-defense should not be collective self-defense. Packing the streets with a mass of people functions as self-defense. When we outnumber the white supremacists 50-1, 100-1, 1,000-1, it never matters that our side doesn't go to the gym as often. Plus, when we outnumber them 100-1, we bust the myth that they're the silent majority. As the Vice documentary in the aftermath of Charlottesville did a good job of illustrating last year, the far right's objective in the present moment is to translate online activity into a presence in the streets. Their politics are therefore predicated on the belief that their sympathizers are far greater in number than the mainstream media might suggest. So what better way to debunk this myth and to discourage others from joining them than to make them look like the fringe pieces of shit they really are? In other words, not all press is good press when it comes to white supremacists. I think it's worth emphasizing once again the composition of the mass mobilizations we strive for. Revolutionary socialists call them united fronts. We may not agree with everything, on everything, with all the organizations that come together to endorse and plan these counter-protests, and that's okay. We want to work with anyone who opposes white supremacists. Overcoming the challenges of coalition work in united fronts pays off, not only on the days of counter-protests against white supremacy, but in the days and months to come, when in the face of ICE raids, or anti-abortion rallies, or police killings, we will have built networks and relationships and trust and won't have to start again from scratch. United fronts against white supremacy have also succeeded in dealing severe blows to the far right in the past year. In Boston, in Tennessee, in the Bay Area, in Seattle, in Burlington, Vermont, the lesson has been the same. Mass mobilizations against white supremacy can turn the tide on the far right. The lived experience of marching alongside thousands of strangers can also reshape us in profound ways. We've all got our baggage. Many people who turn out to these counter-protests against white supremacy carry contradictory, twisted, and sometimes indeed even racist ideas about how the world works. But even when the standards for marching are set oh so very low, for example, do you hate Nazis? Those who do march may very well witness the deference with which the cops treat white supremacists and the aggressiveness with which they treat counter-protesters. This might, in turn, unsettle the common liberal intuition that the police, bad apples aside, protect us. Their behavior toward counter-demonstrators exposes police for what they really are, the violent arm of the state willing to protect racial capitalism at all costs. Consciousness, in short, changes in struggle. I'd not originally planned to discuss free speech in the far right during this talk. Free speech has become, unfortunately, kind of the third rail, or one of the third rails of the campus left, eliciting groans and heavy sighs whenever it's mentioned in a room of activists or organizers. I'm sure some folks have had this experience. I think it would be disingenuous, however, to sidestep the question of free speech altogether. The right has no doubt weaponized, hypocritically, the mantra of free speech in order to ram through much of its reactionary agenda in the past decade or so. From Citizens United to deregulating the pharmaceutical industry, from attacks on reproductive justice to sanctioning discrimination against LGBTQ people, the argument has been the same. The far right wields the mantra of free speech most effectively at universities, exploiting a stated commitment to academic freedom to peddle their racism, sexism, homophobia, and xenophobia. I think it's worth saying up front that revolutionaries must defend free speech. In contrast to what the right, the far right, conservatives, and liberals alike might have you think, the freedom to organize and agitate and publish without government intervention was not a liberty granted benevolently by the state from above, but a right won from below by progressives, radicals, and revolutionaries. And if there is a free speech crisis on campuses today, it's those fighting oppression and injustice who bear the brunt of the attack, silenced when they speak up against Israeli apartheid or speak out against sexual discrimination and harassment. The co-optation of the free speech mantra by the far right is a phenomenon that many are still making sense of, I think. And I won't pretend to have the answers here myself, but I will share an anecdote from my experience at the University of Chicago, where I go to school and where I organize, which brands itself as a bastion of free expression. When former Trump chief advisor and former Breitbart chairman Steve Bannon accepted a business school professor's invitation to speak at UChicago earlier this year, campus and community activists, collaborating with community organizers with the Movement for Black Lives and Reparations at UChicago, occupied one classroom. We held two mass organizing meetings, rallied three times outside the business school, and conducted four teach-ins all in the span of about 5 weeks. And lo and behold, we won. The most recent news is that Bannon has backed out of his agreement to speak, no doubt in part due to the pressure and resistance we mounted on campus. We actually resisted Bannon on campus without getting entangled in the crosshairs of the free speech question, pretty much whatsoever. Critically, we did not call on the university to stop Bannon from speaking. seeing as this would empower the administration to turn around and prohibit activists and scholars on the left from speaking on campus. And we stopped him from speaking before he had even set foot on the South Side. This experience, this victory, might suggest that the debate around confronting far-right speakers on campus often boils down to a far narrower, practical choice than abstract arguments about free expression and Western civilization might lead us to believe. That is, if a far-right speaker does indeed make it all the way to campus, and Bannon did not, we're faced with a choice between A, organizing a small team of people to disrupt a speech from inside the event space, and B, mobilizing mass protests outside the event. So what are revolutionaries in that scenario to do? For the same reasons that we need a mass mobilization instead of a small band of hardcore activists to defeat the far right in the streets, so must we organize as large a mobilization of students, staff, faculty, and community members as possible when the far right shows up to speak in college classrooms. At every turn, we must ask, what can we do now to build the confidence and size and consciousness of the resistance? That said, we absolutely defend those who decide to disrupt events from the inside against any disciplinary action. For the simple reason that, in a contest between racists and anti-racists, between misogynists and feminists, between the oppressor and the oppressed, we stand with anti-racists, the feminists, and the oppressed 24/7, every day of the year, forever and ever. That consciousness changes in struggle in multiracial mass movements is intimately related to the political alternative to fascism that we can offer, and to the world we want to fight for. At the heart of our revolutionary socialism is the conviction that the only way toward human liberation is through the self-emancipation of the international working class. Self-emancipation, of course, means that we can't sit on our asses and watch Nazis on TV until the revolution comes. It means we won't bet on those in power for our freedom, like asking the state and the university to withhold permits. And finally, it means that we can't leave the few to do the work of the many, as Antifa might lead us to believe. As the American socialist Eugene Debs put it, I would not lead you into the promised land if I could, because if I led you in, someone else would lead you out. None of this will suffice. If you believe that we all must participate in the quest for a world in which we all participate, in organizing, creating, decision-making, fulfilling basic human needs, it's called socialism, then it follows that this struggle against white supremacists demands mass participation of all who are able. The politics of the status quo don't appeal to most Americans, anybody in the world, under conditions of economic insecurity and precarity and social alienation, in an era of endless war and regimes of dispossession and climate catastrophe. In fact, the politics of the status quo are incredibly dangerous in that they leave a vacuum for the far right to fill where the left doesn't. Clara Zetkin writes, quote, it would be very dangerous to fail to consider the importance of overcoming fascism ideologically and politically. Now, in filling this political vacuum, our audience is not white nationalists. We'd be content if they return to the sewers of history out of which they have first crawled. But once again, our politics are born out of the conviction that the vast majority of our friends, our neighbors, our coworkers would also like to see them return to those sewers. We must champion movements like Abolish ICE, yeah. Medicare for All, Boycott, Divest, Sanction, and Black Lives Matter, while demanding reproductive justice, a living wage for all, LGBTQ sexual liberation, prison abolition, the overthrow of deportation and war machines. Those are demands that the vast majority of working people can get behind. We recognize at the same time that we won't eradicate white supremacy completely until we, at the very least, eliminate the conditions and tear down the system that make it possible in the first place. For as long as capitalism pits the labor of one race against the labor of another, and the labor of one country against the labor of another, there will always be an opening for fascism. the politics of solidarity and democracy do indeed trump those of hate. But to win a world based on human need and not profit, we will need to be organized. Our objective now, and on August 11th in Washington, D.C., might be to defeat the fascists. But we organize against white supremacy in Berkeley, in Portland, in D.C., across the country, and here in Chicago, with an eye toward organizing for tomorrow and toward human liberation and a world free of oppression and exploitation. Thank you.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.